Our emotions are not right or wrong. They just are. The decisions we make around expressing those emotions is what gets us in trouble.
Hi, welcome to Resonate, conversations and life lessons from Rancho La Puerta. I'm your host, Barry. My special guest today is Dr. Rick Aberman. He is a performance psychologist with over 3 decades experience working at the intersection of neuroscience, leadership, and elite performers. Rick has worked with top athletes, including the Minnesota Twins and the Minnesota Vikings. He's worked with executives and he's worked with organizations. He helps them to unlock potential through mindset, emotional intelligence, and behavioral science. Whether you're leading a team, a group of performers, or striving for personal growth, I think you're going to find today's conversation thought-provoking as it blends science, strategy, and real-world insight. Hey, good morning, Rick. Thanks for joining me today.
Oh, thanks, Barry. It's great to see you.
Yeah, it's great to see you too. So where are you coming today? Are you in Minnesota?
I'm in Minneapolis, and okay. It is a nice, warm summer day, about 90 degrees.
Wow, 90 degrees. It's warmer than it is here in Mexico. So So I was, as I was researching for my podcast, I see you have a PhD in developmental psychology and family therapy.
Yes.
So what made you, were you always interested in that field?
I kind of hate to say it, but yes, I have, since I was a kid, I wanted to be a psychologist. And I think it was because my parents, quite honestly, sent me to a psychologist once because we were arguing a lot and I liked it. And so, since at least the ninth grade, that's something I wanted to do. And I didn't always know it would be family and business and sports, but yeah, that's how it ended up.
What is the difference between a psychologist and a therapist?
So, not really anything. A psychologist can do a lot of different things. Not all psychologists are psychotherapists. I'm a psychotherapist, which is what you're referring to.
Right.
Sometimes some psychologists are research psychologists, or they do testing like neuropsychology, things like that. And so I'm actually more the psychotherapist, and I refer to myself as a psychotherapist.
If someone looks you up online, it always comes up that you work with athletes and high performance, peak performance executives, athletes, those kind of people. So how did you become interested in sports and when did that transition happen?
I've always been interested in people. And through my schooling, when I was working on my PhD, thinking about populations I wanted to work with and my research and in practice, I wanted to work with groups that I knew well. And I've always been involved in sports. I was a runner, not a great runner, but, you know, I knew that a lot of my running colleagues and friends weren't necessarily terribly introspective or understood how to manage internal conflict all that well, other than pushing through it. I wanted to work in sports. And I come from a family-run business. And I was interested in business and wanting to apply sort of the lessons of the office, the clinical office in the business world. And so as I started my career at the University of Wisconsin, I was a psychologist for their athletes, their coaches, their department, both individually and organizationally. I focused my work on those that were pretty successful. And most of my clients are really good at what they do and sometimes the best in the world at what they do. But it doesn't mean that they don't have any issues or aren't feeling isolated or know how to deal with inner conflict. And so that's where I kind of got into that.
Is it typical for like college sports teams or professional teams to have a psychologist?
More so. When I started at the college level, We were the first at the University of Wisconsin to have something like that. The psychology in sports up until that time had been pretty much more, I would say, performance oriented, mm-hmm. like mental skills training kinds of things, visualization, mm-hmm. performance enhancement techniques, things like that. And while I can do that, I never mm-hmm. separate the person from the performance. Mm-hmm. So I'm always one of these people that say, all right, you know, you're pretty good at what you do. So you're a professional football, baseball player, whatever you are. So I'm pretty sure you know how to concentrate and do those sorts of things. But what's really going on underneath the surface mm-hmm. that's getting in your way? And that's really true for everybody. Instead of looking at things more symptomatically, like, you know, what's causing this? What's keeping you from being at your best? And that's really my job, is to help people with that.
Yeah. So what you're trying to say, athletes are actually humans, are they? They have the same emotions and feelings, I guess.
Yes, exactly right. And so are IT people and everybody else.
Is Peak Performance a company that you started?
No. Peak Performance is, I was the director of Peak Performance, which is what the Minnesota Twins gave me as my title.
Okay.
In part because when I started, they didn't want to say psychologist because that implied that they were having problems.
Oh, I see.
And yeah. Sort of this was the old stigma that, you know, still exists in some, to some degree. Right. But in those days, it was something that was kind of outside the box and was, you know, all about dysfunction versus helping people be at, you know, right. as happy as they could be.
Do you work with coaches and players, and do they seek you out, or is it kind of like they're assigned to you?
No, they generally seek me out once in a while. I mean, they may be referred to me by somebody in their organization.
Right.
You know, unless they really want to do it, it's probably not going to be something that we engage in too much.
Right.
You know, I want it to be something that they're invested in. And this is about them investing in their own development. That's right. What we're asking people for. So.
What are some of the common challenges you might see in high performers?
Well, you know, these are people that are really good at what they do. I think we do a pretty good job in our world of helping people to become successful or figure out how to be successful and be at the top of their game, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But what we don't do a very good job of, Barry, is helping people understand what happens when they do become successful. Now what? Mm-hmm. In other words, once we reach a level of success, there's a whole nother set of issues that take place that most people don't really talk about. Because after all, you know, from the outside, you're successful. So what should be going on with you? And, you know, but we are people. Everybody is, you know, we're all dealing with people as human beings. And so a number of things, not the least of which, if I'm supposed to not have any problems and I have some normal developmental issues, relationship problems, occupational, whatever it is, just kind of normal things. Now, all of a sudden, I start to feel somewhat isolated. Like, who do I talk to about this?
Mm-hmm.
I'm supposed to be really good. And I've worked so hard, and maybe I'm a perfectionist, which has helped me get to this point. But it may not be helping me be as happy as I could be. It's gotten me somewhere.
Right.
But I know a whole lot of people who have gotten to really amazing places that aren't necessarily the happiest. Some are, but some aren't. Many aren't.
I'm not such a sporty person, but I do watch Pittsburgh Steelers every year.
Oh,
my family's into that. And
I
also love to watch tennis. And I was just, you know, the Wimbledon recently. It seems like if you want to be at that level, like playing at Wimbledon, you started when you were 6 years old. So how do you, like athletes at that level, how do they find that they're not just that one thing?
Yeah, and that's a great, you articulated that very well. Because when we're good at something, the better we are, the more we become identified as being good at that. And the more our self-concept, our sense of self, how we feel about ourselves, actually becomes dependent on the thing that we do. And so when we look at identity, it's not what we do as a person, but who we are as a person. And so much of the challenge is quite often helping these really successful people figure out how to get reconnected to who they are as a person, because quite honestly, they become distant from it.
Right.
And, you know, they're really good. They function at a high level, but we're not functions. We're people. And with relationships and understanding how to get reconnected to that, that's part of my job, is to help guide them to that. And right. And it's because of the success.
Yeah, it's like a double-edged sword in a way.
It is. So, you know, being isolated and feeling like, you know, who I'm supposed to have all my stuff together. So, you know, I don't want to show any weakness. And that's another thing, you know, high performers, whether whatever sport or business, you name it, is we work really hard at trying to not be vulnerable, when in fact, what we really need to understand is that vulnerability is the only chance we have to be at our best. And let me tell you how I think about it and how I explain it.
Yeah.
You know, you're dealing with the Pittsburgh Steelers or the, you know, football. These are really tough guys and people who have, you know, if they were half sane, they probably wouldn't play football. But, you know, they're good at it and it's great. But in order for them to make a great play, they have to risk that it may not work out.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if I can get to that ball, I'm going to do everything I can to get to it. If I catch it, that's great. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful. But if I drop it, ooh, that's not good. Or if I'm too slow to get there, if I don't think I can. So what happens is subconsciously often is we tend to underperform. I'm not going to put myself in a position to maybe be at my best, because if I'm not, that's too painful.
Mm.
Vulnerability allows me to be at my best and know that if I lay out for a ball and I miss it, I might be disappointed, but my sense of self is not crushed. I'm still okay. My well-being, my confidence, who I am as a person is still intact.
Right.
And that's something we don't teach very well at all. So it's very countercultural, especially to this segment of the population.
Yeah. Because at the Wimbledon final, you know, it was Alvarez and Sinner, and like, I think probably a lot of people thought Alvarez was going to win. And like, they're both insanely amazing. But when you're just because a few shots and now you're number two and no one talks about you, all of a sudden you just disappear. And yet you're
number two.
You're probably just as good. It was just a few things, right? So that's got to be such a head trip for people.
Oh, well, and it is because, you know, sometimes people say, well, there's no number two. There's number one and then there's loser.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as you work so hard, whether it's for 4 years in an Olympic or you work in your career for all these years, you get to this level and you allow the results to begin to define you. Right. That's the kind of craziness that you start to deal with. You know, we can watch from our, you know, as fans and say, well, that's silly. You're number two in the world. But I have people that come to me that are number two in the world and that's not good enough. And I get that.
I get that.
And I'm
too,
not, you know, I understand that, but we have to help them figure out how to stay connected to oneself. And, you know, and tennis is funny. I work with a lot of tennis coaches and college tennis and you know, it's great. And so I have a chance to help in the development of players. It's fun.
You talk about emotional intelligence. And I've seen some of your interviews. So what is your definition of emotional intelligence? Because people use that term all the time.
Yeah, you know, sometimes I think back to the days where I'd give a talk and I'd say, how many people have heard of emotional intelligence? And like, nobody.
Right.
And now, of course, everybody has some understanding, half of which I don't recognize. But so my definition, there's a couple. One is how to be able to stay focused on your goal in the face of often competing emotions. Okay. So we can feel a bunch of feelings all at the same time. I can be excited that I'm going to have a new job. But I can also feel sad that I'm leaving the people that I've been with for quite some time. Emotional intelligence is staying focused on your goal, even though you have that conflict. In other words, I'm going to push for growth in my own development to take the next opportunity that's better for me versus not taking that and staying with something that I'm not, you know, that is more predictable.
Right.
So that's, to me, is one of the biggest things.
Yeah. So I also, there's a lot when you're talking about athletes or high performers that self-talk is important, or visualization is important.
Does
self-talk come before emotions, or do emotions create the self-talk, or does it go both ways?
Well, it kind of goes both ways, but now we're really splitting hairs here. So when we look at things physiologically, the brain, we feel first. We process emotions. We experience emotions first. And it's kind of, we're wired that way, the fight or flight.
Right. So
we don't want to have to think a lot about getting out of a survival situation. We just want to respond, in fact. And sometimes that works for us, and sometimes it doesn't.
Right.
So we actually, what we feel the, we experience the emotions first.
Okay.
And then it's like hundreds of a second later, we are able to process more cognitively, identify what that emotion is. So it happens really, really quickly, seemingly as if it's both at the same time. Realistically, it's just lagging. The thoughts lag a little bit. Now, our thoughts tend to reflect our emotions. Now, our thoughts can also, you know, thoughts and beliefs and things like that. We get a little bit more blurry between a thought and an emotion and things like that. But they influence one another.
Right.
So I think self-talk is important. To me, it's less in terms of success. It's more in terms of, where am I actually at? What is my state of mind now? Like, are my thoughts helping me attain my goals, or are they inhibiting me from achieving my goals? And so that's kind of where I think it's helpful to pay attention to the self-talk.
Right.
Trying to convince myself I can do something generally doesn't work so well. You're a tennis player. You know, if you think about whatever you do, don't hit this particular shot, don't hit the ball there. Chances are you're likely to hit the ball there. Golfers experience, whatever you do, don't hit it in the water. I get up there and where does it go? In the water. It's like, I told myself that, but it's emotional and it's subconscious.
Yeah.
And so that self-talk can reflect an internal insecurity. Like, how come I'm not confident here? Like, what? I'm trying to convince myself to be confident. I shouldn't have to do that. And so that's something that we can, you know, look at a little bit deeper.
Yeah.
So it's information.
Yeah. I'm probably overusing tennis examples because I just watched that. But I also noticed that, like, there's a player and let's say he double faults and then he misses the next shot. You can almost predict he's going to lose that game. Is it because, is it the emotions he's having about missing those shots that is a self-fulfilling prophecy then? Because I see that in football too. It's like that it just energy. You can see the energy change.
Yes. And that's great, great description, because that's what's so cool about sports. You don't even have to know the sport. You can kind of feel the energy. You can see momentum and how people carry themselves, the speed of play, the posture. These are kind of, you know, sometimes they're overt behaviors and sometimes, you know, they're just sort of more subconscious behaviors. Right. And so what happens is that when I'm doing the double falter thing, you know, I have the thoughts, but I also have the feelings. And with feelings and emotions, feelings and emotions impact our physiology. Mm-hmm. So when I'm really excited, my physiology responds and my heart is, you know, beating faster, and I may get more excited. I may tense up. Mm-hmm. I mean, all different kinds of things can happen. Mm-hmm. And I'm not telling my body to do any of those things. It just happens. So our bodies respond physiologically to our emotions. Mm-hmm. Understanding those emotions and managing those emotions, our impulses to act, our expressions of those emotions. Our emotions are not right or wrong. They just are. Mm-hmm. The decisions we make around expressing those emotions is what gets us in trouble. So if I double fault, I'm not feeling too good. I'm not too excited. I'm probably upset. But if I don't manage that, and what I'm saying, manage that in terms of my physiological response, now I'm getting in my own way. The self-fulfilling prophecy is now my cortisol levels, my stress levels, all of those things are elevated. So now what becomes a very natural fluid motion becomes more forced, and I'm not at my best. And so the likelihood of me making a mistake with a highly aroused physiology, I mean, that's just going to happen. Happens all the time. I mean, it's like, have you ever been really pissed off and done something stupid? I mean, we all do that.
Yeah. No, daily.
That's why.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So some more than others.
Hi, my name is Karen Keese, and I'm from San Francisco. I've been to the ranch a few times in the past several years, but this last trip has been extra special. Last year when I was here, I weighed 55 pounds more, and I've lost that weight and kept it off for 6 months. And a big trigger was when I was at the ranch, it disconnected me from processed foods, and I got in touch with how I liked natural foods, the sweetness of fruit. But even more importantly, I realized that I could exercise and do activity more than once a day. That's okay. My self-imposed limitations of, oh, I'm going to play pickleball, so I don't need to stretch in the morning, or maybe I should save myself because I won't have energy later. That was a myth, because here I was doing things all day, taking breaks, 2 or 3 or 4 activities a day. And when I went home, I took that with me and I added the exercise in. And I think that's been key, not only in keeping me active during the weight loss, but keeping it off afterwards. And then to come back to the ranch and repeat the experience has been just super. And I feel very fortunate to be here.
I hope you're enjoying today's podcast as much as I am. To learn more about our wonderful presenters and exciting weeks coming up at the ranch, go to rancholaporta.com and check out our events calendar. Make sure to mention the podcast when making a reservation to take advantage of a special offer. Some restrictions may apply. I hope you are enjoying today's podcast as much as I am. To learn more about our wonderful presenters and exciting weeks coming up at the ranch, go to rancholaporta.com and check out our events calendar. Make sure to mention the podcast when making a reservation to take advantage of a special offer. Some restrictions may apply. So how do you help a person in that position? And I mean, it doesn't even have to be an athlete. Like, for example, I might get up one morning and I get a bad phone call, and then something else goes wrong in the day. And sometimes I feel like I just might as well go back to bed because this day is going to continue to go this direction.
It could, if we continue to reinforce the thoughts, the feelings, and the actions. In other words, if we maintain the physiology, it's probably going to be a challenge. Now, the good thing is, part of what is so cool about emotional intelligence or athletics or performance in general is we have the ability to improve our self-awareness. Mm. I can pay more attention to what the hell is going on with me, what I'm not only thinking, but what I'm feeling emotion-wise as well as physiologically, and then make some adjustments accordingly. So if I'm like experiencing all these stimuli and my system is elevated, my stress levels are high, and I'm aware of that because I'm making silly mistakes, I can get myself to calm down by not just having an awareness, but now recognizing that I can do something about this. I can begin to do some deep breathing. I can get up off outside of my office and go outside and just be outside for a little bit. It doesn't even have to be all that long. But to reset the physiology is what we're trying to do. And we can do that by paying attention to what we feel when we feel it. Mm-hmm. And that's part of having a higher level of emotional intelligence, increasing that ability to recognize.
Right. And so you gave a couple examples, like deep breathing definitely helps. Maybe changing the environment that you're in.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, but if I'm on the tennis court, I don't get the opportunity to do that. So what do you tell someone like that?
So when we look at performance, any area of performance, it always comes down to the same thing in terms of sustained optimal performance is about our ability to make good decisions under pressure.
Mm.
So decision making. We're making a million decisions on the tennis court. Some we're conscious of, some we may have practiced so much we're seemingly unconscious. But we've learned these things. So when I recognize I'm not in a good place, I need to make a better decision. And so I can use visual cues. I can have somebody just get my attention. I can look up in the crowd for a certain physical cue, the flag, or, you know, somebody that I know. Or I can look on my wrist, which, you know, I have a wristband that somebody else used to wear. Whatever, little reminders and cues. Or I can make sure that I slow myself down as the game's starting to speed up. And a lot of times it's not the physical speed of play, but it's our mind has sped up the game as well. Right. And so we want to get ourselves back to a place where we can just get our feet on the ground, get grounded again. And also remember that what we're doing is a choice. Like I'm choosing to play. It may feel sometimes like we have to do these things, but you don't have to play in a finals of Wimbledon. I mean, you want to, but it's a choice. And when there's a big difference between needing something and wanting something. So if I base my sense of self, how I feel about myself, my self-concept on what I do, that better work out really well. Or I'm not going to be feeling too good about myself. So all of a sudden, what I'm doing becomes a need versus a want and a choice. And it's sometimes it's reminding ourselves to separate, as we were saying earlier, between what I do and who I am as a person. And reminding myself that, hey, I've chosen to be here. This isn't this is not battle. This is not war. This is this is not survival. I mean, I would like to be successful, but so that's another thing that we can, another way we can help ourselves or have somebody remind us, a coach help us or a friend.
Yeah. I mean, I've had a therapist tell me before, you are not what you do, right? That's not who you are, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You're pretty good at what you do, which is great.
Right.
But that's not who you are.
Right. But and sadly, the outside world, that's all they know you as often. So you have to Yeah.
That's right. But now you're talking about how do we come together as a team? How do we get along with people? How do we play nice with others? We begin to see them more as people versus functions. And we have to invest in getting to know them. But we start by having to get to know ourselves.
Right.
Like, who am I as a person? Right. What matters to me? What are my values? What are the things that really drive me that I'm in control of, quite honestly?
Right.
I'm not in control of the results, but, you know, if honesty is important to me, that's something that I can live and practice every day. And so when we live in alignment with those things, we're going to not only do better, we're going to be happier.
Right.
And so getting to know people from a leadership standpoint or from a coaching standpoint or a teammate is about not just learning about what somebody does, but what matters to them.
Right.
What are they about? And then coaching them to that, supporting them to live those things. That's how we create bonds. And that's how we create more cohesive teams.
Yeah. Now, and you wrote a book about coaching, right?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Some time ago, Why Good Coaches Quit, which really started out as a talking about clients I'd see in my office, because I only see so many, but they're so representative of such a larger number. And I actually co-wrote it, the book, with a friend and colleague of mine, John Anderson, who is a college baseball coach who just retired and is in the Coaching Hall of Fame after some crazy number of years, 40 years. And but, you know, a lot of my world is helping leaders figure out how to bring out the best in others. That's really the job of a leader. Right. That's your job. That's other people's job. And we have some influence in that. We can enhance that ability or we can inhibit it. But we have to understand ourselves and then begin to understand how other people, you know, it's how other people work and what they're about. And it's, you know, a lot of performance world talks about motivation. And it's not how motivated you are. It's what kind of motivation. You know, is it more internal motivation or is it external motivation? Right. And we know from all kinds of research that when we talk about sustained optimal performance, unless you really want to do it yourself, it's not going to last.
Right.
And so we try and teach people how to be internally motivated in a highly externalized world. That's really the challenge.
That is a challenge.
And when we do that, that's a lot of fun.
Right.
And we can see some amazing results.
When I was in school, they called that intrinsic motivation.
Yep.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about is if you're a peak performer or like a professional athlete, you might have 5 to 10 really good years.
Yeah.
And then you have to transition to something else.
Yeah.
How do you help people with that transition, especially with their identity so wrapped up in what they're, who they have been?
This is a little bit more helpful for people if we can be a little more proactive. So we start helping them learn more about themselves as a person, being able to separate that function from the person while they're playing, because that's going to allow them, one, to be at their best, two, if they get injured suddenly and something happens and they have to quit their sport or can no longer play or whatever it is, it will make that transition much better. So it's getting to know yourself in a way that maybe you just generally don't have the time because you're so focused on what you're doing. So if we start that before, and then it's helping them feel like, you know, you go through this this life where you're so intimately connected and people around you, you know, are supporting you, your support teams and your social life, everything may be about the sport, that when you leave that, it's almost like becoming a civilian again and now having to figure things out on your own and to make your own, make friends on your own and find resources on your own. And it can be a very humbling experience. So that's why you want to start more preventatively while people are playing and while they are doing well at what they're doing.
That's a something that could apply to, like, not just if you're an athlete, because I see that happen to people that retire from careers and jobs. And then, you know, all of a sudden they've been this person, they go to work every day and they talk to these same people and this is who they are and what their life is. And then all of a sudden it's not.
It's exactly right. So like in business, it shows itself sometimes through succession issues. And, you know, am I able to give up what I'm doing to create a successful succession plan so that the company and the business can move beyond me? But if I'm so dependent on that for my whole sense of self and identity, and I'm hanging on as long as I can, and not in a way that's going to benefit the overall well-being of the shareholders in the company, and in the family's case, the family-run businesses.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Well, listen, Rick, it's been so great talking to you, and I appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to talk to us today. And I look forward to seeing you in the future,
hearing
what you're up to.
Yeah, thanks again, Barry. It was a lot of fun.
It was really fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Aberman works with mostly professional athletes, college athletes, and high-performing executives. Yet I think his techniques apply to us all. We all have goals. We all want to be high performers and do the best at what we do. Often we seem to get in our own ways. I know personally I'm always getting in my own way with my thoughts or my emotions or both. Just like an athlete must train his brain to stay focused and control the self-talk, we must do the same in our lives. One of the sports that I really enjoy watching is tennis. And I've noticed over the years that if a player double faults that first serve and then misses that second point, he often tends to lose that game. The reverse is true. If he aces that first serve and then wins that second point, he often will win that game. It's like whatever energy, if you put winning energy out there, it seems to attract more of the same. And the reverse is true. Dr. Aberman talked about how our thoughts can influence our emotions, and the reverse is also true. Having the skills to direct our thoughts and our emotions is key in our ability to be high performers at anything in our lives. Until next time, this is Barry wishing you lots of energy in whatever you do, health and daily joy.